Oh, intermission.
No, it's halftime.
McDaniel will end it in style. Arkansas is in hog heaven. They've won their first ever national championship.
Still missing your free throws, Wes? Who cares? They don't show free throws in SportsCenter.
Here's Washington. On the drive.
I don't know if he'll make any change, but I figure it's time for me to start playing ball.
And they do it in stunning fashion over the number two team in the country.
Fact is, I missed this shot. I walk away. I'm still a chump.
You're listening to the Halftime Podcast.
You know, this morning I was poking around on the College Football Playoff website, and I came across an entry on their Frequently Asked Questions page that interested me, and I found it so incorrect that it needed to be addressed. The entry is listed under the following questions. Quote, why is the playoff not more than four teams? Will the playoff expand to more than four teams? And the answer to these questions puzzles me. And again, I quote, the four-team playoff preserves the importance, excitement, and compelling nature of the regular season, which is the best in sports. It also maintains the tradition of bowl games, which are unique to the American sports culture. The agreement for the four-team playoff extends through the year 2026. Now, you can say what you want about the college football regular season. Important, exciting, and compelling? Yes, all of the above. How about confusing and ill-suited for picking the supposedly best teams in college football? Because that's what the regular season is to me. Is all of this supposed to make sense? How are there four playoff spots but five presumably power conferences and, of course, the conference unto itself known as Notre Dame? And these leagues don't play identical schedule formats, and the teams inside these leagues have dramatically different ways to schedule non-conference foes. And so through the prism of strength of schedule, overall record, conference titles, and the supposed eye test, the best four teams are supposed to be chosen for the four-team playoff. What a bunch of baloney. Listen, I agree that the committee, quote, got it right with the selections of Alabama, Clemson, Notre Dame, and Oklahoma. But let's take a step back and figure out what got it right really means, because the committee might have gotten whatever it is right, but the format of this whole exercise is not right. The conference title games did nothing except rob the Georgia Bulldogs of a chance to play for the national title, so that makes the SEC championship game a de facto playoff game, when the Bulldogs probably should have competed against the Oklahoma Sooners in a first-round game. Those same Sooners that were forced to play against a very good Texas team in their version of round one of the playoffs, while Ohio State and Clemson were allowed to play against decent also-rans. And the Fighting Irish sat in their collective fists for the weekend. Basically, from what I heard from Talking Heads Saturday night, the conference title games made everybody think Georgia is one of the four best teams based upon a loss to Alabama. And that's some that think that this loss to the Crimson Tide was so impressive that the result of the game shouldn't matter. These are probably many of the same people who profess anger at the everyone gets a trophy attitude in youth sports. Final results matter. And we, as people who focus on Arkansas football, know this for a fact. And we were looking for reasons to look past the results this year. But I'm sorry, you don't advance when you don't win, Georgia. I don't care that on paper, and maybe even on the field, you are one of the four best teams in the sport. You shouldn't have lost a three-loss LSU. It's that simple. But I've been convinced from the start that four teams is not enough in a sport that plays 12 regular season games. 1 through 8 didn't change after the conference championship weekend. And the truth is that while we could debate the merits of spots 4 through 8 in the rankings, this year, there's no doubt the best 8 teams in college football are lined up right there in the CFP rankings. And those are the same teams that were lined up 1 through 8 Friday. And those are the teams that should have been part of an 8-team playoff. It's coming. It will come eventually, probably at the year 2027 when the current contract expires. But Ty Richards and I have real trouble with the thought that the idea that you're picking the supposed best teams in college football, and because of the idea that you're supposed to pick the best teams, then we're going based upon paper and the eye test and not the final result of a game that Georgia, they probably should have won, could have won, but didn't win because of a number of factors. And to me, I don't see any way possible that you could put a two-loss Georgia team ahead of really any of the one-loss teams, because to me, final results matter, and the final record should matter. And I'm glad that in this case, the committee feels that it does matter. I think they got it right.
My whole argument on this, Phil, is I think Georgia is one of the best four teams in college football, but I agree with the committee's decision. I know that people are kind of angry that Notre Dame got to sit out in week 14, didn't have to play a conference championship game, but that's how it panned out. They're 12-0. They're entering the playoff with an unblemished record like Clemson, like Alabama. And Georgia had their chance with Alabama, with Tua going down. You had that ballistic 4th-and-11 fake punt call where Justin Fields is easily identified by the Alabama defense. They're not even running a punt fake. We'll get to that. They're not running punt defense. We'll get to that in a bit. But yes, they had a chance to get there and they didn't get it. My whole argument is I just think Georgia is one of the best four teams in college football, but I'm fine with the committee's decision placing who they did in the college football playoff, because I think Oklahoma earned their right, avenging their only loss against Texas. Clemson, unblemished. Notre Dame, unblemished. And Alabama, unblemished. I don't have a problem with how they stood up. I can understand the argument that Georgia is one of the best four teams in college football.
They definitely look like they're one of the four best teams in college football, but that doesn't, to me, mean that they deserve a spot amongst the last four teams. If you have the last eight teams, then you're at a position in a sport where one loss obviously ruins you in the committee's eyes. And, of course, some of that depends on the degree of the loss, who you lost to, the final score. But one loss ruins you. Unless you're Alabama or unless you're an SEC team, one loss does seem to ruin you. And I think in this sport where college football and the one loss kills you for a chance at the title, quite often last year wasn't the case. This year it is. To me it would make so much more sense to add an extra layer of a playoff, where you're really then getting a sense of the four best teams once you actually get into a Final Four, that you can point to results in games that matter from the week before. And now you know, out of the four teams that are left, these really are the four best teams. I mean, there's no argument amongst 1 through 8. And I know sometimes we feel that actually it's a good thing if there are fan bases or teams that have compelling reasons to be in a playoff that are left out, because it generates conversation and it's become something that we're really used to in college football. But there are too many qualified teams that are left out, and really games that I think we would like to see as college football fans that get left out as well. I mean, think about the idea of a Georgia versus an Oklahoma game. We're getting a great game in the first round with Oklahoma versus Alabama, but I do think that you would end up with more compelling games than you get in the conference championships. And I'm not saying that the conference championships don't matter to the players. This is one of the arguments I saw a lot on Saturday morning about how do you think the players feel, the coaches feel about these conference titles. Yes, that's understood. And it's not that we're denigrating conference championships and what those matter. But when this is all said and done, we're trying to figure out the best team in college football. That's why this season is being played. It's to determine a champion. The conference championships, I don't think, do anything to help that argument along. Not this year. And I have the feeling that an extra layer of playoffs would go a long way, maybe to ending some of the arguments. Maybe they don't want those arguments to be ended. But it would also go a long way to really determining who the best team in college football is. When it's all said and done this year amongst the last four, And you end up with one champion, you'll still, I think, feel pretty good about the thought that the champion is the champion and there's no disputing it. But I have a feeling 1 through 8 to me makes just so much more sense. Ending arguments. So then there's the thought that maybe you're arguing about spots 8 and 9 and 10 instead of 4, 5, and 6 like we are this year. So maybe there's an argument one way or the other. I'm not quite sure how to value that. To me, it means more to be a little more inclusive amongst the great teams in college football than it is to generate conversation amongst the fan bases of teams 4, 5, and 6.
Well, I think you're when you do that, you devalue it a little bit. And let me ask you this, Phil. The top six right now, based on the college football playoff rankings, are Alabama, Clemson, Notre Dame, Oklahoma, Georgia, Ohio State. Of those six teams listed, who do you think would have a shot? If they had eight, who do you think would have a shot to win the college football playoff?
You're probably still looking at spots 1 through 5.
Okay. So you don't think Ohio State would have a chance?
I think a lot of us discount Ohio State in some cases. Maybe I shouldn't be amongst that crowd. And the other idea is, maybe 1 through 6. Maybe 1 through 6. The way that Michigan got destroyed by Ohio State, with Central Florida without their starting quarterback. So then maybe there's the argument of 1 through 6, where spots 1 and 2 get a bye, 4 plays. 3 plays 6, 4 plays 5, and then maybe that makes some other people a little happier. To me, there has to be a little expansion, whether it's adding 2 teams or 4 teams and giving, you know, the teams 1 and 2 a bye. To me, 4 teams just is not enough.
I'd be down.
One of the things, I forget the committee, the member that said this, they basically lined up Oklahoma, Georgia, and Ohio State, and were not able to determine amongst them that one of those teams was any better than the other. So then they deferred to conference championship for Oklahoma. At that point, they're taking the Ohio State loss to Purdue as meaning a lot more than Oklahoma's loss to Texas, which they got a chance to avenge in the Big 12 title game. Ohio State beats kind of an also-ran Northwestern team. So that's the argument that you end up getting. And to me, 4, 5, and 6, Oklahoma, Georgia, Ohio State, they might all look like the same degree of greatness, and I just don't really know how you're able to separate all of these teams from each other.
I don't know the logistics of it, but I'd be more in favor of a 6, because, Phil, the reason I brought up the question about that is let's venture into the other teams that would be fighting for that 7th and 8th spot. Do you think Michigan would have any shot to win the national title this year? My answer is no.
Probably not. Going into the Ohio State game, we thought maybe they would.
Yeah, let's keep going. UCF. Now, this is a different team without Mackenzie Milton, but do you think with Mackenzie Milton, this team would have had a shot?
I mean, probably not.
Okay.
I mean, the level of talent that they have at UCF, to me, doesn't come close to what they've got at Alabama.
Okay. Washington, Chris Peterson, Jake Browning, and QB, they got a pretty good defense, but do you think they'd have a shot?
Nope. I doubt it. Florida had their chance.
Florida.
LSU had their chance.
Florida has no offense in Dan Mullen year one. LSU, inconsistent at times. Still had, I mean, just really salty defense under Dave Aranda. But I think that's the argument when you get into, because you devalue it. And those teams, that's the argument that I think it's a pretty good argument. Joel Klatt was making it the other day, where you just look at these teams, and there's just no one on that list, if you had an 8-team playoff, would have any realm of possibility of winning the national championship. Now, 6, you can look back to the first year, the inauguration of the college football playoff. Baylor and TCU got robbed that year. People thought more TCU than anything. But you look at them, I mean, the Baylor and TCU were stacked that year. So the more I look at this, the more I look it over, the more I study it, and again, I don't know the logistics. I don't know what they'd have to do with the bowls. I don't know what they'd have to do with the weeks and everything leading up to it. But I think 6 is a better fit. Like you mentioned, have the bye for Clemson and Alabama, because I think people think those are two, clearly the best 2 teams in college football. And then the other teams, like you mentioned, have Notre Dame play Ohio State, have Georgia play Oklahoma. I'd pay that. I mean, that's you call that a quarterfinal? I mean, that's awesome. I'd love that. I think that'd be incredible. I'm just looking at it the past couple years, I'm just not in favor of 8-team based off the teams that we get in that 7 and 8 spot who have no shot to win the national championship.
Well, let's look to last year's rankings going into bowl season, and 1 through 6 made more sense last year than 1 through 8. You had Clemson, OU, Georgia, and Alabama, the top 4. Ohio State, a 2-loss team, was 5. Wisconsin was number 6 at 12-1. And then the best record after that was UCF at 12-0, and they were ranked 12. So, you know, you could make the same argument from last year to this year the way you're going at it, Ty, with Auburn 7th. You wouldn't have said, Auburn did beat Alabama last year, mm-hmm. So maybe that's
and Georgia.
The case. That would be the case. But then, you know, 3 losses. You're never going to make the playoffs with 3 losses in any regular season for football. USC was 8th, and I don't think you would have guessed that USC would have had a real opportunity on the same field to beat any of the 4 teams that were in that playoff ranking. So, but I mean, it sounds to me you're agreeable to the idea of four is just not enough.
Yeah, the expansion, I agree with Bill Keane. Bill Keane comes on our show weekly on Wednesdays, and he does not think that the playoff will last through the contract. He thinks there will be expansion before the contract expires, and he was right when Bill Hancock came out and said there will not be a playoff, and then there was a playoff. So I'm going to trust his gut feeling on this because I just don't think there's just been too many controversies these last few years of that 5 and 6 spot, really. So I think there's, if you look at just the overall what has happened these last few years, I think you can make a case that adding another stretch of games where you get 6 in, I think that's, I don't know how doable it is, but I think just looking at previous evidence, it might be a smart idea for the NCAA and the College Football Playoff Committee to actually move towards.
But are you excited, Ty, because we're just a couple of weeks away from the start of a football game every day, presumably on ESPN. Bowl season is upon us, which means that we'll have full picks of all of the bowl games, which I'm going to – I have no faith in my ability to pick games anymore. 0-3 2 weeks ago, 3-0 actually 0-3 3 weeks ago, 3-0 2 weeks ago, another 0-3 this past weekend. So I don't even want to pick the bowl games. I just feel I've got no shot. And maybe I'll just have to go by the color of the uniforms. But bowl season is fun, but let's not make this out to be like bowl season is the reason, the tradition, quote unquote tradition of bowls is a reason why we should be keeping just 4 teams in the playoff. I do like how they've used the bowl games for the playoff, but I have a real difficult time swallowing the thought of all of these bowl games being so traditional and so meaningful, and the word champion getting thrown around. I mean, and we make fun of some of the bowl matchups: San Diego State versus Ohio, Marshall, South Florida, FIU, Toledo. None of that has anything to do with tradition whatsoever. When you're talking about tradition and the bowls, you're still talking about the Power 5 teams, the Power 5 schools, and the bowl games that go all throughout the years, talking about the New Year's Day bowls. And that's, to me, you know, maybe the Holiday Bowl, maybe the Alamo Bowl, maybe the Sun Bowl. But a lot of these other bowl games, there's no tradition to them whatsoever. The famous Idaho Potato Bowl, the Dollar General Bowl, the Hawaii Bowl, the First Responder Bowl, the Quick Lane Bowl, the Cheez-It Bowl. I mean, really, none of these has anything to do whatsoever with tradition. They have everything to do with putting a game on television and generating some ratings and making some money for ESPN. That's what bowl season to me means, aside from trying to figure out who the actual champion of this confusing sport can be.
Yeah, I'm with you, Phil. I just don't think there's a lot of intrigue. Hey, we're going to the Birmingham Bowl. Hey, there's been some bowls that have been fun. Like, I enjoyed going to the Liberty Bowl a few years back when Arkansas took on K-State. I enjoyed going to the Texas Bowl when Arkansas took on Texas. But it's just, I think it's lost its luster. And I think the College Football Playoff is partially for that. And I just think that I know it's significant to go to a bowl game because you get those extra bowl practices. These kids get to experience a new city, have a lot of fun down there, do different activities and whatnot. I don't know for the college football public if it's that big of a deal anymore. I think we're trending in the opposite direction where people would rather see more playoff games, which is eventually, I think, what we're going to be heading towards, Phil.
To me, right now, if you're in Arkansas's position, any bowl game would be great. I mean, people would be pretty fired up about,
oh yeah,
about playing in Shreveport or playing in Memphis or playing in the Music City Bowl once again. I mean, they just getting to 6 wins, you almost have a feeling that there'd be a parade through Fayetteville, right down Dixon Street.
Yep.
And we don't care where the team's being sent. But when the team is playing, I remember back in the early part, you know, the mid part of last decade, When you played in the Eye Bowl, that felt like a disappointment. You didn't want to go to Shreveport. You played in the Liberty Bowl. That kind of had the same feeling to it. And I know these bowl games have been around a long time, and they are points of pride for some of those cities. And again, I'm not saying that these bowl games should not be played, but let's not pretend that the tradition of bowl games is a reason at all to make things confusing for picking a college football national championship. That just to me doesn't make any sense at all. And here's the other thing too: traditions. Sometimes the thought of a tradition is one reason why you get held back, because you're reaching back into the old days, and the old days just really weren't the way things should be done. I think Major League Baseball is kind of in that position in the next few years. And you and I have talked about this, Ty. I think Major League Baseball will be doing a full revamping of how the leagues are aligned. I think we're going to have total realignment with the NL and the AL not being the AL and NL that we've all known and grown up. I think it's going to go to a geographically based system. It'll save money. It'll save travel. It'll save time. And it will make probably a better game of baseball. So traditions, you know, celebrate them to a point, but don't celebrate them to the point where the traditions get in the way of making the sport better overall. And I think sometimes that the so-called tradition of the bowl games goes a little bit too far in trying to maybe preserve the way that college football used to be, because it ain't the same sport. It just is not the same sport that it was even 15 or 20 years ago with all the money that's involved in it and the pressure that is involved in it too. To me, you got to get it right, and you've got to have a real champion.
And there's always that push and pull from my generation who wants to do things different from your generation and older generations, where you have, and it even goes with recruiting, like jersey changes, anything involving the sport. There's always going to be new ideas, new flare-ups coming out from the younger generation, the younger crowd, and you're going to get some pushback from people that are older. And I'm not always going to agree with the different new ideas that come into effect, the new thought process and all that. But I think you're just always going to get that, not only just in sports, politics, religion. It's just a never-ending cycle, Phil.
You're listening to the Halftime Podcast. Follow the guys on Twitter at Phil Elson PXP and at Ty Sports Radio.
Beard ahead to Gafford. How about a windmill? Let's put a little exclamation point on it. The Hogs are moving on.
And as we usually do on a Monday, this time of the day, we are going to go with a little three up, three down.
Strike three. Good morning, good afternoon, good night.
What does three up and three down mean to you, Airman?
End of an inning. Strike three.
I'm going to start in the NBA. Did you see where Patrick Beverley dislodged the tooth of Dennis Smith Jr.?
Yep.
He did it inadvertently. It was an interesting day for Patrick Beverley, by the way, but that's not the reason that I have him in part of this three up, three down. Dove after a loose ball, he and Dennis Smith Jr., and Smith ended up on the wrong end of it because he took Beverley's elbow on the face, and it knocked out a tooth. Now, it didn't knock the tooth out from the root. It broke the tooth off. And you could see on the replay the tooth just fall right out of his mouth, and it didn't look like a little piece of a tooth. I mean, it was a giant chunk of it, probably two-thirds of the thing. And so, I mean, my up here is Dennis Smith Jr., the second-year Dallas point guard out of NC State, who went all hockey player on us yesterday. I've always said hockey players really, to me, are the toughest of all the guys who play professional sports, because they're the ones that – will take a puck to the face and have 14 stitches put on their cheek during the second intermission, then come back for the third intermission and keep skating around delivering checks like it's the first of the month. Well, Smith went all NHL on us yesterday because this occurred near the end of the third quarter in Dallas's game, and he did leave. He left the remainder of the third quarter, but only after winning the jump ball. And then came back with 10 minutes, 45 seconds left in the fourth quarter. And Smith ends up coming up huge with a blocked shot of Tobias Harris, who's about 6 inches taller than him. That was with 12 seconds left, preserving Dallas's two-point win. So Dennis Smith Jr. is my first up, because when you get a tooth knocked out and you come back just minutes later and end up making the play that won your team the game, you didn't just go all NHL, you went Superman NHL. And oh, by the way, Beverly was later ejected from this ball game for throwing a basketball at a fan that apparently said something about his mother.
Yeah, it was an explicit comment towards his mother, and you can, if you have any sense of an IQ, you can guess what it was talking about.
My first down, we go all the way over to the Pac-12. I don't know if you've seen this four-part series in the Oregonian, which is the newspaper of choice in the Portland PDX area, but they tore apart the Pac-12 office, specifically going after Commissioner Larry Scott. Now, the Pac-12 misses out on the college football playoff for the third time in 5 years and really didn't even get anybody close as far as they were concerned. Only one team will be playing in a New Year's Day or Eve bowl, and this is not, it's not the hallmark of a Power 5 conference. So this series by the Oregonian points out many of the ways in which the way that the conference operates financially seems to be way out of place compared with the other Power 5 conferences. You know those other Power 5 conferences that have football programs that win games, bowl games too, go to playoff games, and also don't have some nobody up in the conference review office making decisions on replays that shouldn't be made because he doesn't have the expertise to do that. That's another problem that the Pac-12 was dealing with earlier this year. So they focus on the money. Now the Pac-12 generates $10 million fewer per conference member each year than the SEC does. If I remember the numbers correctly, $41 million doled out to every school in the SEC by the SEC League office, $31 million doled out to the Pac-12 schools. So, and that's year after year, and that's the way things are constructed for the next, I think, six seasons. So that's $60 million more that all of the SEC teams or SEC schools will generate from their league offices than the Pac-12 schools will generate over the next 6 years. And the one of the reasons why the Pac-12, why their football is not near the level of the SEC is the money that is generated, and that, I don't think there's any other two ways to look at it. So part of this is, where does some of this money go to? Larry Scott is my first down. He's the Pac-12 commissioner. He is the highest paid of all of the conference commissioners at $4.8 million. He makes more money than any of the football coaches do in the Pac-12. Greg Sankey, who may be the best of all the commissioners of the Power 5 conferences, makes a measly $1.9 million. So that's about $3 million fewer than Larry Scott, the commissioner of the Pac-12. And it's pretty easy to tell which of the two conferences is more successful, certainly in the sport of football. The Pac-12 offices also were moved by Scott from a low-rent area called Walnut Creek, California, that was in the Bay Area, and now they're downtown in San Francisco, where they pay nearly $7 million in annual rent. They have lavish salaries for the Pac-12, for the Pac-12 staffers. The top five staff members in the Pac-12 make a combined $8.4 million. The top five in the SEC make a combined $3.9 million. And this is where you can watch almost any SEC game, not just on the national networks of CBS, ESPN, and what have you, but also the SEC network is pretty much the best of all the college networks. And the Pac-12 network is nowhere to be found. They're not even on DirecTV. Mike Neighbors joked with me yesterday that there are more subscribers to the Pac-12 networks in China than there are in the United States. And then he looked at me straight face and said, "I'm not kidding." I don't think he is kidding. It is the truth. Pac-12 staff members, travel costs over $3 million. SEC staff member travel costs under $800,000. So it just, you know, it, and then you end up with a Pac-12 title game that was about as entertaining as watching worms race. 10-3 final score, no offensive touchdowns, four interceptions. Didn't even get to 500 total yards between the two teams, Washington and Utah. So I think that there's a direct correlation that you can point for the quality of football play to the Pac-12 to the money that is made by those who run the Pac-12 league itself and the way that they operate it, because it just seems that it might mean to the Pac-12 people that their office is more important than the members are, you never get that sense from the SEC office. You always get the sense they're working for the SEC members, and I have a feeling that those in the Pac-12 feel that it's the other way around. So Larry Scott would be my first out. He's the commissioner of the Pac-12.
So we had Brooks Ellis on last week, and of all the questions he answered, we talked about Brett Bielema, his time at Arkansas. This was the most important question he answered. What's your favorite bar on Dixon Street?
I mean, you can't go wrong with D-Bar. That's a classic. It's just the bar that everyone goes to, and that's my favorite, I guess.
So I was up in Fayetteville this weekend, Phil, and the new shtick of Z-Bar is they sell champagne bottles by the bottle.
These are bottles for popping, right?
Bottles for popping, yes. And I've been in bar in Dallas where they sold malt 40s, and every like bar has a funny stick, like a girly drink or just something like that. But it was just crazy that like just people are just walking around drinking out of a champagne bottle. Like it was the craziest thing I've ever seen. Like there just multiple. One of my buddies, like, he got three off the bat. He just went up and said, "I'll take three champagne bottles," and the bartender just looked at him, started shaking his head, and then got him. It was just, it's just such a weird phenomenon that the band, who's the bar owner up there, just started. It was pretty incredible. So that's my first up. Which
you know, the thing about champagne bottles is they are not really designed for drinking out of. They are designed for pouring champagne out without it being drunk. If you try to drink champagne out of a bottle, the stuff goes right up your nose.
It comes right back out.
You need to put it in a glass and go from there.
And that happened to me that night because someone decided to shake it up right before they handed it to me, and then I got it all over my jacket, my veil pullover that day.
So
that
the next
night.
Thing you got to do then is you got to make it a wine bottle because that won't fizz up in your nose. They can shake it. Nothing's going to explode, but you will be the only goofball at Z-Bar who is drinking straight out of a wine bottle.
Yeah, it was a little interesting. So yeah, that whole phenomenon is my first up. First down, this affects you and me both. James Conner goes down last night. I don't know the extent of his injury, but I'm very scared, Phil, because our group has decided what the loser of our fantasy league is wearing at Comic-Con, and it's a Catwoman outfit, 100% leather.
You look awesome in this.
I hope I don't have to experience what I look like in it, even though it would be funny. I don't want to be dressed in head to toe in leather, Phil, but there's a very realistic possibility that I could be it, because James Conner was my bell cow. He was my dude, and now he's out. And my team's falling apart, 5-8. I think I've lost my past three games. So my first down of the weekend is the very realistic possibility that come after this fantasy football season, I'll have to wear a Catwoman suit to Comic-Con, which I'm not looking forward to whatsoever.
I just want to hear you say Catwoman suit to Comic-Con fast three times. And I'm going to tell you, you're going to have to go out and sign Jalen Samuels, right? He's the Steelers' backup running back.
Yeah, but
now.
Is he really going to get that much? Like, that's what our commissioner said I needed to do, but is he really going to get that much love? You think it's that worth it to go out and snag him?
I think they got to throw to somebody out of the backfield, and he might be the guy to do it. So
okay.
I would advise picking up Jalen Samuels. All right, number two for me, I'm going to go with this whole best four teams argument in the college football playoff. It's not about the best four teams. It's about the resume that you put together. It is about the results on the field against the teams you play and how they stack up to everybody else. Two losses for Georgia. I don't care that position by position they would probably stack up better than any of the other teams that are in this playoff against the Alabama Crimson Tide. And the proof is what we saw in the SEC championship game on Saturday. I think Alabama is a better team than Georgia, but I don't think that they're not two touchdowns better than Georgia. But the results on the field have to matter for something. If you're going to play a conference championship game, then what happens on that field has to matter as far as the playoff committee is concerned. And there's no way, not this year, a two-loss team, no matter how talented they are, no matter how they stack up against Alabama or against Notre Dame or against Oklahoma or anybody else, none of that matters when you lose two games in the season. And so it might not have anything to do for Georgia that they were this close against Alabama, that they were just maybe a couple of special teams plays away from a win. What matters to me, you shouldn't have lost to LSU. You should not have lost to LSU, and that, remember the Tigers, they They moved the ball against that Georgia defense. And there's no way that should have happened. You can't lose to an LSU team that was so, I wouldn't even say one-sided offensively. I mean, they were completely limited offensively most of the season. You can't lose to that team and still make a best four teams argument, because you're not one of the four best teams if you now have two losses, and one of those was to LSU. So, and this goes back to my argument in the first part of our game, of our show today, that the results on the field have to matter for something. Otherwise, why do you even play the game? So that's my second down. Second up is Kristen Williams, former CAC basketball player out of Little Rock and the National Gatorade Player of the Year last season, now a freshman at UConn. Kristen Williams announced her presence with authority yesterday for the UConn Huskies. And I love, in women's basketball, you have this UConn-Notre Dame rivalry where they play each other nearly every year now, and it's pretty much one versus two whenever they play. So the game was in South Bend yesterday, and it was a blowout. UConn wins on the road 89-71. Kristen Williams scores a game-high 28 points as a freshman, 14 of those points coming in the first quarter. That's announcing your presence with authority when they defeat the team that knocked them out of the Final Four last year, won the national championship, was picked to defend that national title this year, and had been undefeated up to this point at home in South Bend. Kristen Williams, that's big-time stuff, and she's my second up today.
I got to give my second up to the alma mater, Little Rock Christian Academy. They defeated Pulaski Academy 48-32 in the state championship on Sunday afternoon. And look, I was headstrong. I didn't think the Little Rock Christian stood a chance in this game. I was riding high on Kevin Kelly's prior success and the fact that he had won 60 straight games against in-state opponents. And Little Rock Christian, especially Justice Hill, I mean, the guy passed for 218, had two touchdowns throwing, and then he rushed for 112 and two touchdowns. He talked to us when we had him back on the day of his commitment to the University of Arkansas, how he was excited to hopefully play Pulaski Academy, his former school when he was in elementary school, and the team he hadn't suited up against, and he came through. Also, a kid, John David White, who got, I think, a preferred walk-on opportunity at Arkansas. The guy, I mean, John David White was spectacular. He had over 200 yards and four touchdowns, and I grew up with his cousins, and I met him a couple times. He was a lot younger than me, and I reached out to him on Twitter. I was like, hey man, as an LRCA alum, I was rooting for us, but I couldn't help but rooting for you just and doing what you did. Congratulations on a great season. Hope to see you up at Arkansas. Hope to see what you can do if you end up choosing here. And he was like, yeah, thank you, sir, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, it's the weird phenomenon of people that like are close to my age, because I've kind of passed that threshold, which is like, I guess, 22, 23, where people start calling you sir.
How old they are, not how old you are.
Exactly. Anytime like someone like calls me that, I just like laugh, because it was so ingrained in my system from an early age with my dad. That was just such like a thing he taught me early on, and I was annoyed by it, just by every time if I didn't say sir, he would correct me and say yes sir, and like stuff like that. But it's paid dividends, and I'm glad I have that in my system. But that was kind of funny. Second down for me, how about the fake punt call? 4th and 11, 3 minutes to go in the SEC championship,
and it's a fake. Justin Fields,
oh my gosh, it was 4th and 11.
Alabama's gonna take over at the 48-yard line.
Kirby, what are you doing? 4th and 11? Everyone knows what Justice Field looks like. Like, everyone on Alabama's defense knew what was coming. It was going to be a fake. Maybe
really
not.
Think that they were. He was going to hide Fields behind the lineman on this punt.
They weren't even in punt safe, Phil. They were in a defensive formation, and they still decided to go ahead with it. That's on. I don't know if you can put 100% the entirety on that on Justin Field as a true freshman. You got to call the timeout if you're the head coach or the special teams coordinator. You need to go up to Kirby and say, we got to get a timeout. Like, this is not going to work. And they went through with it, got blown up at the line of scrimmage, Phil. That was just an embarrassing moment for Kirby Smart. I just don't know how you can call that play in that situation that late in the game. I know the defense, you're scared of the dynamic offense that Alabama has. And even though Jalen Hurts had come in after Tua, you're just still worried that he could possibly lead them down. But, Phil, you can't do that in that situation. That's my second down of the weekend.
Yeah, I mean, at that point, you got a little more than 3 minutes. You stop him, you get the ball back, maybe in with good field position, and you might be able to win the game on the legs of your field goal kicker. So, yeah, that was a big head-scratcher. My third up, and I had to think about this a couple of ways. You know, we talked about it with Brett Good. We had a fan of the Packers call up last week.
Yep.
And firing Mike McCarthy before the season is over, I think to many seems like a head-scratcher and almost a disrespectful way to depose a Super Bowl-winning head coach who'd been there for 13 years. But the more I think about it, the more it makes a lot of sense and might actually be more respectful to Mike McCarthy because now he doesn't have to stand up there at the press conference each week and ask and answer the obvious question, which by now it just seemed to be obvious with Green Bay now going to miss the playoffs for the second year in a row. And I think it's the first time they're missing the playoffs back-to-back years since the early 90s. It seemed like a foregone conclusion that Coach McCarthy would be shown the door. So why would you make him stand there for the next 4 weeks and the Packers organization for these next 4 weeks spinning on their heels and knowing exactly what's going to happen, that the coach is not going to be around come January? So now McCarthy doesn't have to answer these questions. Neither does Aaron Rodgers. I'm sure that they'll, you know, there's a press conference today for Green Bay where they can get all this stuff out. But now they can start the process of moving forward, which is better for the Packers as a franchise. And it's also better for Mike McCarthy as a head coach. I don't know what sort of opportunities will be presented for him, but, you know, with his offensive mind and maybe an OC position, but also with the success he had at Green Bay, there could be another head coaching position in his future. And it all gets things started a little earlier than maybe expected. But I think that it also shows more respect to Coach McCarthy because, I mean, look, if they fired him while he's walking off the field, it'd be a different story. He was asked to go into the office of Mike Murphy, the president of the Packers after the home loss to Arizona, and they did it right there. So it just seemed like it was actually a little more respectful than if they waited and made this next month completely unbearable. All right, my third down is my health. I'm traveling with Arkansas women's basketball these days, Ty, and when I'm on the road with Arkansas athletics, to me, it can mean a lot of things. It can mean games to call. It can mean traveling and air travel and ballparks and arenas that are a lot of fun to go to and different fan bases and hearing different traditions from where we're going. Games are always fun to call, but it also really, to me, at the end of the day, means bacon. It just means a lot more bacon because these hotels that we'll stay in are either Hilton's or Marriott's, and those are two chains where you can rest assured that the bacon is going to be crispy,
plentiful,
tasty, and plentiful. That's right. Even more than plentiful. It's like a never-ending fountain of bacon. You know those chocolate fountains you'll see at Golden Corral or at some weddings. This to me, these breakfasts are like a bacon fountain. And I might as well just liquefy the stuff and drink it because I think I had 10 pieces yesterday and I just can't stop myself.
Just 10?
Just 10. That's
just
right.
10.
So I could do this as an up or
a
down.
Boy, man.
Cholesterol up, health down.
That's all right. It's part of it. You'll bounce back. When New Year rolls around, you'll start getting in the gym more and stop eating bacon. So it'll be good. You just got to wait till the new year, basically.
We'll see about that.
All right. Third and final up for me. How about the Kansas Jayhawk mascot when they were introducing Les Miles at a Kansas Jayhawk basketball game, bringing Les Miles grass from their stadium?
What kind of grass did he bring him?
I don't.
Oh, you mean real grass? You
real
mean like
grass.
The kind of grass that's on a football field or on a baseball field?
And Les Miles in front of the entire crowd ate a piece of it. So I love that. I thought that was awesome. So you need to see that on Twitter if you haven't seen it. The third and final down for me: the fact that Johnny Buckets has not scored yet, Phil. I was so disappointed. End of the game, Arkansas had a fast break. Desi Sills is on the fast break against Florida International, and Johnny Buckets is right behind him. And let me tell you something. It doesn't look like it. He can dunk. I've seen him do it. I played with
You've seen him dunk?
Yeah, I've been in the practice facility with him when he's dunked the basketball.
He wasn't standing on a ladder to finish the dunk?
He's got some underrated athleticism. And the guy only gets about 2 minutes a game, and I'm thinking, Desi, get in the ball, get in the ball, get in the ball, get in the ball. And then Desi goes up and dunks, and I'm like, oh, that's so, like, that's just so painful because,
Desi got to get his before Buckets gets his.
I know, but you don't get many fast break situations with Johnny Buckets. And you're, like, even at the end of the game, even though it was a blowout at that point, that crowd would have just been electric, and it would just blown the top off Budweiser Arena. But unfortunately, we didn't get to see it, Bill.
Subscribe to the show on iTunes. You're listening to the Halftime Podcast.
Clutch blood running through Daryl Macon's veins. The Razorbacks win it 71-70.
Go right to the hotline, and Jimmy Dykes is joining us, ESPN basketball commentator, former Razorback, of course. And it has been a while, Jimmy. It is great to talk to you. How are you doing?
Phil, I'm doing great, man. How are you guys today?
Doing wonderful. Got back from Ames late last night, hanging out in Fayetteville today. And, you know, I got to say, as Ty and I have been talking about the college football playoff rankings quite a bit today, you have to be ecstatic that the sport that you are involved in, everything is just plays out on the court. Now, I know that the committee's got to pick 1 through 68, and there is controversy when teams that people think deserve to be in the tournament are not in, but it seems college basketball does it the right way, and sometimes I wonder if college football does not do it the right way.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of validity in what you said. That's the great thing about college basketball is you get 3 or 4 months to try to, you know, sort through who are the most deserving and the automatic qualifiers you get in that tournament. And then once that bracket's up and the ball's tossed up, you play your way through that thing and you earn it and you deserve it. I'm not saying that you don't in college football, but the opportunities that are there for a team like Loyola last year that went to the Final Four, no one a year ago, no matter what they tell you, was saying that Loyola is the Final Four team. But, you know, you get in that tournament, you get in your bracket, and you play well and good things happen for you. And that's the beauty of college basketball. That's you're right. That's why I love being in the sport. I've seen a lot of teams already this year across the country that, you know, could certainly get to the Final Four, if not win it. There's the nation right now is, I think, really loaded with a lot of really good teams, like really good teams. I don't see a Villanova a year ago we were already starting to see that was a great team. Maybe Gonzaga keeps going the way they are. We start talking to them about being a great team. Michigan has come out of nowhere, and they look like they've got a chance to get right back there again to that Final Four, if not the title game. But there's a lot of good teams out there, and it's going to be another great tournament. There's a lot of ball to be played between now and then, but all the eyes will be on college basketball in March, I can promise you that.
Well, and as this year was a year that a lot is expected out of the SEC, took a good step forward last year, and, you know, a lot of the programs now are starting to kind of gel around some of the newer head coaches. So I'd add, and Kentucky, I guess, is the easy answer as far as an SEC team that looks like a possible Final Four qualifier. But who else in the early portion of the season that you've seen out of the SEC stands out as a possible contender aside from Kentucky?
Well, I wouldn't say that Kentucky is a Final Four contender right now. I did their game Saturday. I've seen them 3 times this year. I did their game Saturday at home against UNC Greensboro, who went to the NCAA tournament last year. They have a majority of their team back, and Kentucky took a step forward last Saturday in terms of from where they were in the Duke beatdown to where they are now. I think they have a possibility of getting there, but right now Auburn and Tennessee are better than Kentucky right now. But this is still just the 1st of December. That could change by the time we get to conference play. Auburn and Tennessee are really good. They're old, and old wins conference championships and old wins national titles. And Villanova and North Carolina, the last 3 national championship teams we've had, Villanova twice, those are old teams with old guards, and I think you got to look at teams like that. And in the SEC, Phil, the league has stumbled a little bit coming out of the gate. Outside of Tennessee and Auburn, who have held their expectations as a top 10 team, you know, Kentucky really hasn't. That beat down by Duke kind of really set them back, and Now we have to wait to see if they can win some meaningful ball games. They have coming up against North Carolina and Louisville. And then after that, you know, LSU lost a couple of times over Thanksgiving break. They were a top 25 team. Mississippi State's still hanging in there. They had a good win over the weekend at Dayton, a team that I saw in the Bahamas. I thought that was a good win to keep them in the top 25. But the injury to Jontay Porter at Missouri is a big hit to them. The injury to Darius Garland at Vanderbilt is a big hit to them. Florida's trying to search and find out who they are. They're not a complete team right now. Probably the team that's the biggest surprise in the league is Arkansas. I mean, they were picked 10th, and from what I've seen from them, regardless of the rest of the league, from what I've seen from Arkansas, I think that's a top 5 or 6 team in the league. I really do.
And we'll get into your thoughts on Arkansas in a moment. I was real brief about the Kentucky loss to Duke and the way they opened the season. It isn't that they lost. It's that they got blown out of the water and didn't even look like they belonged on the same floor at times with that Duke team. That you feel that loss set them back in a way where no matter what they do up until perhaps, you know, this point of the season or once they get into conference, that statement loss to Duke means more than anything else?
Well, I think it does until, like I said, they have to go win a meaningful, hard game. And that's coming up on their schedule before conference play begins with North Carolina and Louisville. They win both those games, and we all feel like Kentucky's one of those 8 or 10 teams that could win the whole thing. But that had to be a little bit of a shock to their confidence. I know it was. I've been around that team more than any other team in the country so far this year. I think they went into that Duke game a little arrogant, a little not realistic in terms of how hard it is in college basketball to win those kind of games. And I think they've learned from it. I know they're a better team. They are a much better team now than they were on that night. And Duke is not as good as Duke looked that night, and Kentucky's not as bad as they looked to be that night. Somewhere a lot closer to the middle are those two teams. But I think it's one of those losses that kind of hit John Calipari and his guys right in the nose. That kind of staggered him for a little bit, but they are better. I had them Saturday, and again, they beat a very good tournament team in UNC Greensboro, and I think I have them in a couple of weeks against Utah, so we'll see if they continue to improve. But right now, to sum up the league, I would put Auburn and Tennessee 1 and 2, and you could flip those however you want. Then after that, I would probably still go with Kentucky, and then it's Mississippi State, Arkansas, LSU. That's kind of how I see it.
Jimmy Dykes, SEC Network, former Arkansas Razorback. Jimmy, you mentioned how Arkansas has been surprising. They're a free throw and a play away from being undefeated. Why do you think this team has come so strong out of the gate, despite not a lot of experience?
Yeah, I mean, they would probably be a top 25 ranked team had they won that Texas game on a neutral floor, and they should have won it. You go back and watch the last minute; they literally just kicked the game away and didn't execute like you have to execute to win. But that being said, they're receiving votes in the poll that came out today. The win against Indiana was a good win, a win that you have to have on your home floor. And I think they're a good team. I think defensively they're so much better than they were a year ago. I think Mike's best offensive players are now also some of his best defensive players. That hadn't been the case the last 2 or 3 years. And I think their pieces just fit together a lot better than they did in the past. So I'm not saying they have better talent. That's to be determined, because Barford and Macon were stinking really good players, man. Those guys were good. But I just think the pieces fit. I think the point guard, Harris, is just a really good, solid, you know, not going to turn it over, high assist, the turnover ratio, makes his free throws type kid. And then the shooting ability of Isaiah Joe and Mason Jones are, you know, kind of keep them, have the ability to just make some big threes and keep the defense off of Gafford. So I like Arkansas. I will not be surprised at all if they don't enter the SEC with only one loss. And I think they have a very manageable schedule. Their first 3 games at A&M, they come home to take on, I think it's LSU and Florida, 2 winnable games on their home floor, and then they would be like 14-1 heading into a game at Tennessee. I'm not promising that's going to happen. I'll be more surprised that it's not like that than it is. I think Arkansas is a good team. I think they got a good schedule now in front of them.
So looking at Jalen Harris, he's 7th in the country right now in assist-to-turnover ratio, just had a 10-assist, 1-turnover performance against Florida International. Do you think that's the biggest piece that Mike Anderson has missed in his Arkansas tenure as a point guard?
I don't know about his tenure, but I know this kid's really good. You know, if you have 39 assists and 5 or 6, 7 turnovers, whatever it is, I don't care who you're playing. You're taking care of the ball, and he knows how to play. I haven't watched an Arkansas game yet. I've watched him on Synergy several times, just kind of breaking him down to get a feel for him. And I think he more than defends that point guard spot very, very well. He's not a shooter. You know, the last time I looked, he was below 20% as a three-point shooter and below 35% from the field. So that's, he's not going to beat you shooting, but he's going to beat you defending the spot, taking care of the ball, and getting the ball in the hands of Gafford, Joe, and Jones, who he knows as well as everybody else, that's your three best offensive players.
Jimmy Dykes joins us here. You can follow him on Twitter at Coach Jimmy Dykes. And, Jimmy, it's the second year back in broadcasting, and I kind of wondered about this. After your stint as the head coach at Arkansas, did that change any way that you view your job as a color analyst or the way that you broadcast games on ESPN? Because there is some of the preparation that would be a little bit similar, but I just wonder if that kind of changed your mindset as a color analyst coming from the position of head coach.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question. I think it does for all of us. You know, Tom Crean and I got to be really good friends last year when he was at ESPN with us after being fired at Indiana, and now he's at Georgia, and he's going to do a great job. And I think he and I probably talked more than any other analyst I talked to all year. But what it does is I think it opens your eyes again. I mean, Tom was having his eyes open in a different way as an analyst for us because he got to travel around and watch how everybody else practices and how they prepare for games. And it was a really good year for him in terms of continuing to refine who he is as the head coach and what he values. And my 3 years as a head coach coming back, flipping the door the other way is good for me has paid off as an analyst because I now kind of see the game through the head coach's eyes. You know, I'd only been an assistant for Coach Sutton at Arkansas and Kentucky and Oklahoma State for the most part, and scouted in the NBA. And you see the game differently as a head coach. So I think it has helped me, and so I'm very appreciative of that experience and love being back with ESPN. They called me the day after I'd left Arkansas and said, "Man, we want you back." And so it's been a real blessing in my life. I love the job. The travel gets a little old. I'm looking at my January and February, and I'm just literally gone pretty much both all those months, January, February, and March. It's not quite as bad on us in November and December, but you know, like we start off the broadcast, it's just such a great sport to be a part of and follow and watch kids develop and watch surprise teams and just kind of see how it plays out. And so hopefully my enthusiasm for the game comes through on my broadcast. I hope it does.
Jimmy, kind of to go off your broadcasting career, is there a play-by-play guy out there that you haven't done a game with ever that you really want to with?
Oh, man. I worked with, gosh, I don't know. Brad Nessler was my longtime partner for so long. I still think he's as good as, not the best out there. You know, his call in the SEC championship football game was one for the ages. I've gotten to work with most of our guys, the ESPN, even Dan Shulman and I. We did a game together, you know, 10 years ago before he really, you know, kind of became our number one play-by-play guy on the basketball side. So, I don't know. I think it might be fun to do a game with Gus Johnson. I mean, he's on a different network, and right now our paths would not cross at all because he's with Fox and I'm with ESPN. But I like his enthusiasm for the game. You know, some people don't, but I think it'd be a fun broadcast to do, maybe do a game with him sometime. But other than that, the guys I work with at ESPN, one of my main partners this year will be Carl Ravitch. And, you know, he's outstanding with our coverage of Major League Baseball. And I'm happy to be partnered up with him on ESPN Super Tuesday games this year. And really, anyone I work with, I just hope that I don't mess them up, you know, because you're with ESPN, they're really, really good. So I just go into every game hoping, man, I hope I'm prepared and do my part because I know the guy beside me is going to do his.
Jimmy, I know you're speaking Ty's language when you're talking about Gus Johnson because that's his favorite guy. I'm a little hurt you didn't say me. You would do a broadcast with me after all these years. But I will say,
man, that's,
I know,
right.
It's another analyst. I'd love to hear a game with you and Bill Walton together. I think that'd be fun.
Oh, my gosh. That'd be a train wreck. I have no idea. Have no idea half the stuff he covers, but it is entertaining.
That's true. That's true. It's been entertaining talking with you, Jimmy. We got to leave it there. Let's do it again sometime.
Yes. Have a good afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
Winning isn't everything. It's the only thing. You're listening to the Halftime Podcast.